Thank you for that introduction. So it's kind of a relief being at a big agronomy meeting to see some other people working with alternative crops other than corn, wheat, and soybeans. So I'll start by giving a little introduction to what chia is. It's a member of the mint family. It's known as Laminaceae. It's a crop that's native to southern Mexico and Guatemala. It was very popular with the Aztec people and other people from pre-Columbian times. And when Cortez came over, he had them replaced with European alternatives. So the reason that chia is seeing an agricultural resurgence today is because it has the highest known levels of omega-3 fatty acids of any modern crop plants. So to refresh you guys on your plant biochemistry and your oil biochemistry, omega-3 refers to the location of the double bond. So here we have it. The omega carbon is the last one on the chain, so the omega-3, the double bond's on the third carbon. That's known as a linolenic acid, and if you look at some of these crop plants we're surveying, chia comes in at the highest with about 62% of the total fatty acid composition. So as I said, it's very common in Central America, but it's not grown in the United States, basically because you have problems with flowering limitations. Fortunately, research at the University of Kentucky did a mutagenic study, and they developed long-day flowering cultivars, which expands the area of cultivation. So our first situation that we saw was the control like this, lots of vegetative growth, no reproductive growth. At this point, this was probably early September. So you do get flowering, and you start to set seed with this, but you don't get enough seed set. Basically, it doesn't set quick enough for the seed to mature before the frost kills it. So with our long-day flowering mutant, at the same time, we have pretty much, you see the blue flowers developing here, and you have less vegetative growth. So basically, you have a situation where you develop quickly enough. So if we look here at the regions in the blue and the green, those are the areas of normal cultivation. In the yellow, we have areas that can be grown in the U.S. with irrigation, and the red represents the area the long-day mutants can be grown. So when we were developing these, we used gamma mutagenesis and EMS radiation. These two sources of radiation indiscriminately produce mutations, so any nucleic acid has the same probability of being mutated. So this leads to some interesting things in our population. We can have a lot of variability in the seed composition, and the one that we're really interested in is the fatty acid, because that's where most of the value from this crop is derived. So we're going to hypothesize that if we don't affect any of the genes that are needed to develop things like protein, oil, and fatty acids, we won't see any differences in some of our cultivars. So this also brings up another possibility. You probably are going to develop some variability in your population when you do this because of the nature of the mutagen. So this variation is actually useful for developing NIR and NMR calibrations. Is anybody familiar with this machine right here? It's used mostly for larger crops like corn, wheat, and soybeans, more of the established crops, but basically allows you to get oil and protein data non-destructively. It's very popular with breeders since you can use only a small sample size, get all the composition data you want, and then go plant your crop whenever you feel like. So basically this works by translating a regression equation from the reflectance data into composition data. So we're going to hypothesize that like these other crops, we may get a signature reflectance that is amenable to develop these calibrations. So for our methods, we got the lines from Dr. Tim Phillips, who's our breeder at University of Kentucky. We used a couple different measures to get the chemistry. We did Soxhlet for the oil content, direct methylation for fatty acids, and a Kiesdahl analysis for protein content. After this, we were able to develop the calibrations using a partial least squared regression. We did this with the help of Dr. Paul Armstrong and David Honings at Perton. They have the technology to take that and turn it into a program that you can use on an NIR machine. So basically, the first thing we want to look at for our results is our seed composition. So our big traits are over here. Is our oil traits, our protein, are the ones important for this part of the study. So you'll notice our coefficient of variation, around 6% for the oil, and then we have around 10% for protein. when you develop these calibrations, variability is very important in these different for these different traits. Generally, you want at least 5%. If you can get closer to 15 or 20, that's even better. Because of the nature of this crop, it hasn't been overly, it hasn't been developed much as far as the different germplasms. So this is about as much variability as we can expect from this kind of new crop. You can see we had to do a very large sample size over here, so 120 for protein, and eventually we were able to develop 116 for the oil. If we look at oil composition, we're going to see a trend here. On this axis here, we have our different seed lines. Pinta is the parental cultivar, and these are various different cultivars that were mutated. On this line, we have the percentage of the total oil, so this is our fatty acid composition, and our different fatty acids over here. One thing you'll notice if you take a quick look, you do see significant differences between the 18.2 and the 18.3 fatty acids in G3. This is an example of that variability that we're looking for to develop the calibrations. It's also possible this has a genetic link. So basically, if we go back to talking about biochemistry, this could be a case where an omega-3 desaturase gene was mutated, and basically you have either a knockdown of function or a loss of function, which results in reduced amounts of 18.3. So this line's not very agronomically useful, but it's useful for helping develop our calibrations. When we look at the IR profile of this population, we have our wavelength here on the bottom on the x-axis. On the y-axis, we have a reflectance index. So you'll see, if you look, you'll notice that there's a profile that all these seeds kind of follow, but they're at different reflectance intensities. So it's these differences that we can use, similar to soybean or corn, to develop these to develop calibrations. So we, with the help of, like I said, Dr. Armstrong in Manhattan, Kansas, we were able to start developing the partial least squared regression equation. Once we develop the equation, we basically feed back those, we measure the protein and oil again using that equation, and we basically develop what's known as a prediction model. So we have our observed levels from the wet chemistry on the x-axis. On the y-axis, we have the prediction of the protein. And you can see we tried this for whole and ground seeds. One thing you'll notice is that they blend together, which tells us that the quality of the calibration is the same for the whole and the ground seeds. A couple of the parameters we're interested in are our root mean squared error is about 0.95. The R squared is about 80%. And our average difference of protein oil ends up being plus or minus 0.72% in this case for protein. We're going to notice a very similar story for the oil content. The axes are the same here, and you can see the parameters are very similar to what we're seeing with the protein. So our root mean squared error is around 0.97, R squared 78%, and our average difference is about 0.68% plus or minus either way. So what we can conclude from these things is that we observed the variance in seed composition we would expect from a mutant population. We found that Chia's IR profile was sufficient to develop calibrations to a decent level of accuracy. And at the end of the day, the accuracy is within plus or minus 1.5% of your actual measurement for most of your samples. So that's good. And with soybeans and other crops like corn, that's closer to anywhere from 0.75 to 1%. So a couple of the issues, like I said, we have with chia that are going to need to continue to develop is we're going to need to see more of the more germplasm development so that you get more variability in your seed composition. And we're also going to need to see things like a more uniform seed coloration. A lot of the lines that we're working with look a lot like this. You have a lot of variability, not only in individual each seed, but within the seed and between seeds. So those can also affect the infrared region. So what we want is something like this. This is salvia. You can buy this in the grocery store. And you can see it's a nice white, pure line. And that helps reduce another source of variability that could improve the accuracy. So I'd like to thank all you guys for your time, for listening to the talk. I'd like to thank these people who helped complete the work, and especially the small grain growers, the Kentucky Seed Foundation, and Perton for all their help. So with that, I'll take any questions you guys might have.
How much time from
Okay, so how much time from germination to seed formation, right? So generally, when we're working with this line, like I said, the key is it does exhibit chilling stress. So we have some variability between the different lines we're working with. But generally, we plant these in May, like I said, to avoid any frost issues we might have. And seed set generally occurs in about usually early July. You start seeing your development, and then your seeds mature usually by September.
How big was your mutation population, and have you guys got those expressions that are you saw in Mexico and other places, right?
Okay.
Did you get that to actually build your curves?
Sure. So the question was, how big was the mutant population, and did we use different accessions? So in that population, you saw of about 120 different accessions. Those are from about 10 different lines, or I'm sorry, it was more like, I guess it was 25 lines grown over different locations to help cause more environmental variability. And we also had, I think, a dozen or so lines included in there that were also from Mexico. I think we even have some stuff from Australia and Argentina where they also grow it. So thank you.
You have a question? No, okay. Oh, then, okay, there's more questions. Okay, go ahead.
So, in which form is human consumption of the seeds? As seeds or powder or oil, how it is?
Okay, so the question was, how is this consumed by for human consumption. So there's a lot of different forms out there. Some, like I said, the salvia you saw on the last slide there, you just buy that as whole seed. People like to put that in like smoothies and stuff like that. It kind of adds, when you put this in a smoothie, it kind of releases a gel. Some people like that texture, some people don't. I find this an acquired taste. But some people like to do that with it. You can also, the ground form you don't see so much because you have oxidative stress going on with the omega-3s when you grind the seed. But you referred to supplements. So they're actually using this, you think of a fish oil supplement normally, but they use krill for that. This is much more sustainable than krill, and it doesn't give you that fishy aftertaste either. So that's a nice little plus. And you can still get all your omega-3s for the day. So thank you.
One quick question. Is the NIR very sensitive to the seed color?
Okay, so is the NIR sensitive to the seed color? That's something we haven't looked at specifically. Some of the literature suggests in these different crops like wheat, where you have some differences between like hard winter wheats and stuff like that, you would need a different set of calibrations actually. So I would imagine it makes a difference, but we haven't examined that any further. So thank you.
Good.
Great. Thank you very much.